Thank you. In the secular age, as Charles Taylor has amply illustrated in his later big book, religious belief no longer structures our social imaginary. Instead, it has become one option, one possibility among others, one of the ways in which we give meanings to our lives. So the secular age is characterized by the fact of pluralism, an irreducible pluralism of beliefs, values, commitments. And at the same time, and that's a paradox, we secular moderns also give a special place, a special primacy to the idea of freedom of religion. And in fact, in liberal political philosophy, freedom of religion is standardly presented as the archetypical liberal right. So the paradox is this: how and why do we protect freedom of religion in an age where religion is not special? So here's one plausible solution to this paradox. So you could say roughly that freedom of religion is in fact a subset of a broader class of freedoms. So instead of seeing religion itself as a special good, we could say that religion is one of the ways in which we seek the good for ourselves. So exercising one's freedom of religion is one of the ways in which we exercise a more generic freedom, which you might call moral freedom. So I want to call this an egalitarian solution to the paradox I started with. So an egalitarian theory of religious freedom doesn't deny that religious belief is special and should be respected and protected. But what it denies is that religious belief is uniquely special. So the idea is that you can and you should analogize religious belief with other kinds of beliefs and commitments. And I think that many contemporary liberal philosophers are egalitarians in just this sense. So if you read John Rawls, Rawls argues that what the liberal state protects is our ability to form and pursue what he calls comprehensive conceptions of the good. Some will be religious and some will not. Or Ronald Dworkin sees what he calls ethical independence as the core value protected by freedom of religion. And his last book, which just came out as a posthumous book, is entitled Religion Without God. Martha Nussbaum, a few years back, wrote a book on liberty of conscience, and likewise she connects freedom of religion to a conscientious search for ultimate meaning. So what I want to do in this talk is to focus on another theory, another version of this egalitarian approach, and that's the one propounded by Charles Taylor and Jocelyn McClure, a little book we came out a couple of years back, I think, called Secularism and Freedom of Conscience. So in that book, Taylor and McClure put forward their own egalitarian theory of religious freedom, and it's quite a radical one. It's a radically inclusive one. So they argue that all meaning-giving commitments, that's their phrase, meaning-giving commitments, should be protected on the same basis as religious commitments. And this book is also, I think, fascinating when you read it as a statement of Taylor's broader political theory. So it's a more normative companion to the more historical, epistemological, and philosophical diagnosis of our contemporary condition that you find in The Secular Age and his earlier book, Sources of the Self. So to put my cards on the table, I agree with Taylor and McClure that normative egalitarianism is the right response, ethically speaking, to the moral pluralism of the secular age. But I want to raise some problems with that kind of move. So I want to suggest that they, so Taylor and McClure, very much like other egalitarian philosophers, have underestimated the profound tensions that beset egalitarian theories of religious freedom. So the question I want to ask is, what does it mean exactly to treat religious and non-religious conceptions of the good alike? In virtue of what should non-religious commitments and lifestyles be analogized with religious beliefs and practices? So equality sounds like a good idea, right? But what is the currency of equality? So equality of what? And it seems to me that in seeking to answer these questions, egalitarian philosophers are unavoidably drawn to making the kind of judgment they just want to avoid, namely value judgments about the ethical significance of particular beliefs and preferences and lifestyles. So in other words, what they cannot do is to stick to their preferred idea of neutrality between conceptions of the good. Right? The point of being an egalitarian is you don't want to side with one conception of the good over another. Right? What I try to argue is that this is impossible, because you have to define what the currency of equality is when you're going to treat non-religious and religious conceptions alike. So they must identify among non-religious conceptions those that deserve to be treated on the same plane as religious conceptions. So they must identify a criterion with which to determine what within a particular system of beliefs and commitments deserves to be respected and protected. In the end, I argue that these tensions and these difficulties can be traced back to the difficulties of identifying a liberal theory of the good in the secular age. So in a world where conceptions of the good are irreducibly pluralized, individualized, and subjectivized. So in brief, the story I want to tell is also a very Taylorian story, because those of you who know Taylor's early work, this is someone who had raised early question marks about the very idea of liberal neutrality towards the good. So that was by way of an introduction. So let me tell you a bit more about what goes on in the book, and then I'll offer an assessment of the reasoning. So what Taylor and McClure do is that they write within a particular context, which is the Canadian context of the debate about reasonable accommodations. And they begin by defending the idea that members of religious minorities have a right, on non-discrimination grounds, to enjoy similar opportunities to practice their religion as members of the majority. So this is a straightforward egalitarianism, right? If a member of a majority has some rights, then members of a minority should have the same rights. And I have no quarrel with the idea, and I've argued along similar lines in relation to the hijab controversy that Sarah, in a book that Sarah mentioned earlier. But I want to focus on the second main point that Taylor and McClure make. And that's, or rather they don't make properly, I think, because the question they don't actually ask is, in virtue of what are religious believers entitled to special consideration in the first place? So before you want to equalize between majority and minority believers, you need to have given an explanation or justification of why religious belief is protected in the first place, right? So it seems to me that the debate about reasonable accommodations assumes that religious practice is respectable qua religious, and that existing accommodations of religious beliefs and practice is legitimate. So that they protect some kind of basic fundamental good or value. But what is that? What is the fundamental good or value that freedom of religion protects? And I think it's important to formulate an answer to that prior question. Why? Because remember, we're talking about accommodations, that is, exemptions from general law, right? So every law, inevitably, will create burdens for those who have to obey it. So if we are to provide a justification for exempting some of us from those burdens, we have to have a strong one, right? You have to explain why. Say, I don't have to obey the law, and you do. And as I suggested earlier, the formally egalitarian answer, which says, well, if the majority has it, then the minority should as well, clearly won't be sufficient, because we need to know why some members of the majority have exemptions right to start with. So why is religious conduct protection worthy in the first place? So the answer that Taylor and McClure point to is this. They say religious belief for purposes of legal exemptions should be seen as a subset of a broader category of beliefs which deserve protection. And they call them moral beliefs, which structure moral identity, or what they call meaning-giving beliefs and commitments. And they want this to cover quite a broad spectrum of non-religious beliefs and practices. So they cite secular pacifism, and they cite ecocentric vegetarianism, through to duties of care to terminally ill loved ones. So you see that this notion of meaning-giving commitments is broader than that used by other philosophers. So by contrast to Rawls, they do not insist that individual beliefs be comprehensive, that they cover all aspects of your life, right? And by contrast to Nussbaum, they reject her emphasis on ultimate existential questions. It's a feature of the secular age, they say, that people's ethical commitments take the form of, and I quote, fluid, eclectic sets of values, which are not integrated into a comprehensive whole, don't have to be, and they're not perceived as unconditional rules for action. But at certain times, however, so the illness of a loved one, the pursuit of certain core values, become care or love, become paramount and gives meaning and shape to one's life. So in sum, we could say that Taylor and McClure take the ethical pluralism of the secular age more seriously than other egalitarian philosophers. Because you could argue that Rawls and Nussbaum still hold a traditionally religious understanding of the scope and of the content of what counts as a morally weighty secular belief. By contrast, Taylor and McClure, and here they draw on Taylor's early work on sources of the self, and in that book, Taylor rehabilitated the moral dimension of what he calls ordinary life. And they draw on this rehabilitation of ordinary life, and they detect pockets of moral depth in our ordinary life, in the sudden encounter with finitude in the event of the death of a loved one, or in ecocentric vegetarians' profound convictions about the wrongness of meat consumption. These are their two favorite examples, that's why I keep repeating them. So what makes these commitments particularly weighty is that they allow individuals to live with integrity, where integrity is defined as congruence between your perceptions of your duties and your actions, your actual actions. Right? So what the end-of-life caregiver and the ecocentric vegetarian have in common, and with the religious believer, of course, is that they seek to act in accordance with their conscience. So here I stand, I can do no other, as Martin Luther is thought to have said. And Taylor and McClure very much take this on board, and they argue that forcing someone to act against their deep conscientious convictions constitute a moral harm, equivalent to the kind of physical harm that justifies the special accommodation of citizens with physical disabilities. So they conclude, citizens with intense meaning-giving secular beliefs, as well as religious beliefs, have a prima facie claim to be considered for exemptions for burdensome laws. Now, this claim, as I said, is only prima facie because There's a whole chapter dedicated to limits to accommodation. Right? So you may think of the standard limits to accommodation, the rights of others, the compelling interest pursued by the law, or the undue hardship caused by accommodation. So I will not go into the question of the limits of accommodation. I'm really interested in the principle, or the main justification for accommodation, even if we concede there are limits to it, of course. So what's quite interesting about this justification, I think, is that Taylor and McClure have considerably expanded the range of beliefs and commitments that have a claim to be considered for special protection. So they have provided a novel philosophical justification for accommodation itself. So to sum up, they reject both the content and the scope criteria for a secular belief to be as morally weighty as a traditional religious belief, but they retain a third criterion, which we could call the categoricity criterion. Right? So secular beliefs are morally weighty when they are categorical, when they prescribe duties of conscience. So this is more or less the summary of the part of the argument in the book that I'm interested in. It's only a few pages. So the question I'm interested in is, so have they solved the paradox I started with? So have they developed a plausibly egalitarian definition of morally weighty beliefs, which is not biased in favor of religious belief — that's the whole point of being an egalitarian in the first place — but which at the same time adequately protects the underlying values expressed by the idea of freedom of religion? So my assessment is in two parts. In the first, I draw attention to one significant virtue of their account, which is that it implicitly relies on a very Taylorian idea of strong evaluation, and I'll get back to this in a minute. In the second part, I will cast some doubts about the viability of that conception, and in particular about the viability of the individualistic, Protestantized, subjectivist conception of a strong evaluation that underpins their account. So let me start with the first point. It seems to me that in their reasoning, Taylor and McClure get to the heart of what I think is a key feature of freedom of religion, and one that is strangely neglected by contemporary liberals. And it's this. You might be familiar with what Taylor said in a very influential article in 1985, I think. It's an article where he distinguishes between negative and positive freedom. And he argues many liberals are very taken by the idea that we should favor negative freedom because this allows us not to make any evaluation of the good that people pursue when they are left to be free. So they should be left to pursue the good in the way that they see fit. And in his critique of that view, Taylor said that negative freedom really is empty, is totally empty without what he calls a strong evaluation of what it allows the pursuer of. And it seems to me that this insight, whatever you think about whether it applies to all freedoms — I don't think it does, but I do think it applies, I do think it applies to freedom of religion. It seems to me that freedom of religion, by contrast to more generic freedoms, freedoms of thought or freedom of belief, freedom of association, freedom of religion relies on a moralized distinction between valuable and non-valuable activities, and really serves to protect a subset of the former. So it's a freedom to pursue a specific end, an activity that we call religion. It refers to the pursuit of a conception of the good that has a specific shape, a specific content, a specific form, rather than the means through which any conception of the good can be pursued, which would apply to freedom of association, thought, and belief, right? Furthermore, in the case of exemptions and accommodation with which we are concerned here, freedom of religion demands of positive assistance in pursuing those activities, right? So it means that it cannot just be a negative freedom. It means that when adjudicating such claims, it must be decided which claim correctly expresses the values underpinning the general principle. So even though they actually do not draw on Taylor's earlier writings, it seems to me that the notion of strong evaluation very much underpins their account of freedom of conscience. So they're quite open about the need to make strong evaluations about the values that freedom of religion is supposed to protect. So this confirms, I think, the long-standing Taylorian view that rights protect substantive values. So we care about rights, about freedoms, because of the good that they protect, which cannot be reduced to individual freedom of choice. And so they don't shy away from what philosophers call perfectionist evaluations. They contrast a trivial commitment with a central commitment, or they contrast mere preferences, so my preference a classic example, ice cream flavor or a sports program or whatever. This is a trivial preference or mere preference against core convictions. Right? This is what I mean by strong evaluation, to be able to discriminate what actually matters to people's life as opposed to what just a trivial brute preference that they happen to have, but we don't have to respect. Or we don't have to grant special respect in the form of special accommodation. And it seems to me that such perfectionist discriminations are inherent to any serious reflection about the value of freedom of religion in the way that doesn't to the value of other freedoms. But I accept that's a controversial point. Okay, so you may ask, but then who's going to make the strong evaluations required to distinguish between meaning-giving and trivial commitments? And Taylor and McCure's emphatic response to this is the individual claimant herself. So here, they anticipate the charge, which was often leveled at Taylor's earlier conception of positive liberty, the charge that the idea of strong evaluation really could give the state, the government, or judges, the authority arbitrarily to discriminate between better and worse ways of exercising your freedoms. Instead, Taylor and McCure assert that, and I quote, the special status of religious belief is derived from the role they play in people's moral lives, rather than from an assessment of their intrinsic validity. So they defend what they call a subjective conception of freedom of religion, according to which only individuals, not the state, nor religious authorities, are in a position to explain which particular beliefs and commitments are key to their sense of moral integrity. So when claims come to court, judges only have to assess whether the claims are made with sincerity, whether they're plausible, whether they're sincere. So the point here is it's a minimum test that would rule out, when possible, fraudulent or pretextual claims. But ultimately, the subjective conception of freedom points to the sovereignty of private strong evaluations, if that makes sense. Yeah. So I think there's quite a lot to recommend in this account, to which I'm quite sympathetic, but I think it's also plagued by a number of tensions and difficulties. So I'll mention two, I think. Let me see. Yeah, two. Okay, so the first one I want to look at is what they do in effect is to collapse religion into conscience. Right, and they assume that the latter category, conscience, is more inclusive than the former. That you can redescribe the whole of religion as conscience, in other words. But we may wonder whether this is the case. So we may wonder whether anything is lost in the redescription of freedom of religion as freedom of conscience. So assume I'm a devout Muslim. I observe Ramadan. I say my prayers every day. I wear hijab. I give zakat. And I send my children to Quranic school. Right? Or assume I'm a practicing Catholic. I observe Lent. I do not eat meat on Fridays. I celebrate Easter. I go to church every Sunday. And I have my children baptized and confirmed. For many Catholics and Muslims, and the same would apply to other Christians and Jews and Hindus and Buddhists and so forth, the religious experience is fundamentally about exhibiting the virtues of the good believer, living in community with others and shaping one's daily life in accordance with the rituals of the faith. So these rituals are meaning-giving, and they're connected to believers' sense of their moral integrity, for sure. But are they duties of conscience? They're often described as such, certainly in law courts. They often are. The hijab case is a very interesting example of this. But they probably misdescribed. So think of the good religious life as a life of constant, difficult ritual affirmation of the faith against the corrupting influences of the secular world. If you look at it in that way, it's not often one in which one single obligation, say wearing a particular dress or going to mass or going to mosque, or it's not often the case that one single obligation is so stringent as to promise eternal damnation if it's not fulfilled. So what's happening in Taylor and McClure, I think, is a reinterpretation of acts of habitual, collective, embodied practices of religious devotion as Protestantized duties of conscience. And while this description tallies with the individualization and subjectification of religious experience in contemporary societies, it also has two unanticipated consequences, I think. So the first one is that it quite perversely encourages the most fundamentalist and rigid interpretations of religious dogma. So what it does, for instance, is that it rewards those Christians who present their objection to homosexuality as a matter of conscience. So here I stand and I can do no other. Over and above those habitual believers who seek to accommodate their religious life to a secularizing world, often with considerable unease and forbearance. So that's, I think, another paradox in insisting that only beliefs that are intensely held and experienced as categorical duties should be candidates for reasonable accommodations. Taylor and McClure end up accommodating those with the least reasonable beliefs. Now, of course, you might think, but surely only claimants with intense and categorical beliefs are likely to be candidates for accommodation in the first place. But the problem is that the dilemma about accommodations is used by Taylor and McClure to try to identify the values underpinning freedom of religion itself. So if that's the case, I think the questions are asked are legitimate. That is, questions about the broader implication of the reduction of religion to conscientious duty. So at this point, one may ask, but then why didn't they stick to, why didn't they opt for a weaker interpretation of conscience, that which protects all meaning-giving and integrity-constituting commitments, rather than the strong interpretation which focuses on the more problematic category of conscience? The main concern, I think, for them is about the proliferation of claims, right? If you start giving exemptions to anyone with a meaning-giving commitment, then you have a slippery slope of a growing number of claims. So they note that quite plausibly that values such as political ideals, professional fulfillment, and artistic creativity are meaning-giving and integrity-constituting. But they generally do not generate claims of special accommodation because they are linked to flexible and fluid, not overriding and stringent obligations. It's only an exceptional case, hence the case of the ecocentric vegetarian and the caregiver of a terminally ill parent. So it's only in those cases that secular beliefs can generate something like an absolute categorical obligation. I will not eat meat, and I cannot leave my dying spouse on her own or on his own. The strong interpretation of freedom of conscience, then, allows Taylor and McClure to sketch a manageable theory of accommodations where only beliefs with a certain degree of categoricity, conscientious beliefs, are accommodated. And of course, the administrability of exemptions is a legitimate concern. But the singling out of categoricity as the necessary trigger for protection raises its own problems, because it draws a normative wedge between two kinds of meaning-giving commitments, those that are inflexible and conscientious, and those that are habitual and embodied. And this has the effect of singling out individual conscience as opposed to community membership or cultural membership as especially worthy of protection. And I think this is also quite surprising in a Canadian context, especially given what we know about what Taylor has otherwise written about cultural accommodation. So in a Canadian context where cultural identities often feature as the paradigmatic meaning-giving integrity constituting commitments, their lack of reference to culture and notably the cultural dimensions of religion is surprising. So in light of Taylor's seminal contribution to the normative theory of multiculturalism, you would have expected that this last book would take seriously the cultural dimensions of religion instead of proposing a Protestant interpretation of what within religions is worth protecting. So the upshot of their theory is that a sense of communal membership or cultural identification of ritualized practice is not among the values that freedom of religion can be said to protect. So consider the following practices, which, just to be more concrete. So the following practices currently in many countries generate rights to exemption from general laws on religious freedom, on religious freedom grounds. Accommodation of religious dress in the workplace, the ritual killings of animals for halal or kosher meat, tax exemptions for religious charities, church autonomy in the appointment of its leaders, think of the ministerial exemption, so-called. Well, quite interestingly, none of these things can be described as conscientious activity, and therefore it's quite unclear whether they would be entitled to accommodations under Taylor and McClure's theory. So it's quite interesting that it's a self-proclaimed inclusive theory of freedom of religion, but it actually excludes what most religious believers would take to be freedom of religion to be about. So that's the first difficulty. The second difficulty is connected, but it's focused on the subjective notion of freedom of religion. So I think they make it easy for themselves by only looking at, you'd think, what are morally admirable commitments, right? Pacifism, caring for the sick, protecting animal rights. Right? These are all intuitively admirable. But of course, it's not difficult to think of a range of conscientious actions which may be morally trivial, morally wrong, or morally bad. Right? And in those cases, the question is, should individual strong evaluations be supreme, or are different standards called for? So two issues. First one is how to distinguish between trivial and morally significant beliefs. And the other one is how to distinguish between good and bad beliefs. So on the trivial versus significant divide, what I find quite troubling is that Taylor and McClure assume that we all have a consensual understanding of the difference between a morally trivial and a morally significant act. Right? But it seems to me that under conditions of moral pluralism, it's precisely those kinds of strong evaluations that are likely to be contested. So consider the classic American case. I don't know if you're probably familiar with it. So that's the peyote case in the US. So the use of peyote, so that's it's an hallucinogenic drug that is used within Native American ceremonies for religious purposes. So this is an otherwise illegal drug for which an exemption is made when it's used for religious purposes by Native American communities. Now, this is considered, quite rightly, I think, by the Supreme Court as a spiritual act that therefore falls under the free exercise provision of the First Amendment. Right? So the Supreme Court considers that practice as a religious practice, even if in the particular decision I discuss, which is the Smith decision of 1990, the Supreme Court actually argued that it didn't generate a right to accommodation. So peyote was not accommodated, but it wasn't because it wasn't religious, you see what I mean? So I'm interested in the first prong, which was that it defined the practice religious, and then on other grounds decided not to accommodate it. I don't want to discuss that. So what I find interesting is this. So how do we know when injecting drugs is spiritual, right? So clearly you think injecting drugs merely to get high would count as a trivial, frivolous purpose, whereas injecting drugs for spiritual purposes rightly falls under the category of a morally significant act deserving of protection. So if you put it in that way, you say, yeah, of course, for the Native American ritual, of course it's fine. But if it's simply for recreational purposes, then of course it's not fine, right? But there's a lot of gray areas between the two cases, right? So what if individuals not belonging to what the courts recognize as a religion sincerely claim that they are using drugs for spiritual purposes. Right? So does spiritual purpose extend to, and the case I have in mind are really not exotic cases, right? So it would be dealing with depression, seeking higher truth through controlled intoxication, or dealing with existential pain. I mean, are these trivial, or are they morally significant justifications for using drugs, illegal drugs? So the broader question is, you know, in the secular age, how do we draw the line between the spiritual and the trivial? And who's going to be the judge of someone else's spiritual integrity? So much for the, you know, how do we distinguish trivial from significant? The second question is, does freedom of conscience permit individual to do bad or unjust things? Right? Because I said Taylor and McClure make it easy because they come up with nice cases of pacifism and caring for the sick, etc. But they really avoid the difficult question of whether freedom of conscience positively protects a right to do wrong, to use a famous phrase, right? And that's a really tricky question, I think, that I'm hoping to say more about it in the future. But it's a really tricky, tricky one. So, and one very preliminary hypothesis I want to make is this. So, in the philosophical tradition of thinking about conscience, whether it's the Greek tradition or the Buddhist tradition or the Muslim tradition or the Jewish tradition, Catholic tradition, or the Kantian tradition, and that's just a few of the traditions that have thought about conscience. In all of them, conscience is respectable and admirable, not only as a subjective individual faculty to live in conformity with one's own good, but it is more deeply respected as the faculty to live in conformity with what one sincerely perceives to be the demands of the good. And this is, I think, why Antigone's dilemma is so poignant. Right? We still recognize Antigone's dilemma because it's really a tragic choice between two objectively recognizable moral obligations. In the natural law tradition, conscience is the faculty with which individuals exercise practical judgment about how to apply a general objective moral law to concrete cases. So, of course, individuals are fallible and consciences may err. We might disagree about whether Antigone did the right thing. But the one thing that conscience cannot do is demand us to do evil, inhuman or outrageous things, even though it can mislead us about the good. So it looks as if there's going to be quite a deep and quite a complicated connection between respect for conscience and a non-subjectivist assessment of its content. And if that's the case, then individual strong evaluations will likely to be an unreliable guide about what conscience really requires of them. So, where does this leave us? So, to conclude, I still think that this very small book of Taylor and McClure, I mean, I strongly recommend that people read it because it's very small, it's very succinct, but it's really a very interesting attempt to articulate the morally admirable human faculties traditionally protected by freedom of religion in ways that try to respect the pluralism of the secular age. And I have pointed to some problems which are, I think, not so much fatal flaws as unavoidable tensions within the political, legal philosophy of religious exemptions. And my suspicion is that liberal so-called neutrality about religion ultimately piggybacks on a baggage of ideas, conceptions, and values that originally made sense in a world comprehensively structured by a broadly Christian ethics. So in that world, it's in that world that early liberal ideas of toleration and freedom of religion were articulated, Christian ethics provided the moral framework within which strong evaluations between good and evil, between the trivial and the significant, those evaluations were kind of taken for granted. And then it could be coherently assumed that religion was a good thing, so freedom of religion was later to be considered a good thing because religion itself was a good thing. And so any activity pursued under the aegis of religion was also therefore good, and that churches were alternative, self-standing sources of normativity to that of the state. So on that view, religion really operated as a kind of normative black box, the content of which the state could just try to ignore. And it's very much when this box is thrown open by the egalitarian impulse of the secular age that the need for strong evaluations reappears. But I've tried to suggest that those strong evaluations are inherently problematic in a world where there is no publicly validated religious or moral faith, and where the state is expected not to take sides between different ways of conceiving and living the good life. So egalitarian liberals, and not only Taylor, but I think, and I've argued elsewhere, Dworkin and Rawls and others, they've really struggled to define in a way that is suitably non-sectarian and evaluatively neutral the morally admirable faculties that traditional freedom of religion can be said to protect. Taylor and McClure, as we saw, promisingly seek to locate those human faculties in the moral predicaments thrown up by ordinary lives and in the strong evaluations that individuals make in the process. But I have suggested the emphasis on conscience tends to favor a Protestantized understanding of what a religion is, and it also relies on an implicit, unarticulated theory of the good. And it's a fitting way to conclude this text, which I wrote for Taylor's 80th anniversary in Montreal, and I was a way of celebrating his work. And I think to end on that conclusion kind of illustrates one of Taylor's, I think, most profound contributions to political philosophy, which is that he really pointed to some very troubling difficulty with the liberal idea of neutrality towards the good life. So what I've tried to do is the sketch of a kind of Taylorian critique of Taylor. But I think this recent work so points to the formidable challenges that still await the underdeveloped philosophical project of making sense of the idea of freedom of religion in a secular age. But that such a philosophical project is difficult and complex doesn't imply, of course, that it's not worth pursuing. Thank you. Excellent.